You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk with a physicist about why the unfolding narrative of the universe is the best story humanity has to offer.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. It was a big week for Wisconsin. The Budget Committee held hearings with state agency heads to discuss the upcoming two-year budget.
J.R. Ross is here to break down some of the biggest news out of those budget hearings. He's the editor for WIS Politics. J.R., welcome back.
How are you guys doing today?
Good, thanks.
Good.
Well, let's start with this rape kit backlog story. How did this come up in the Budget Committee hearing?
Well, you have to understand that these agency briefings are basically a chance for lawmakers on the Joint Finance Committee to kind of get their first whack, if you will, at the budget, and also for the members of the minority to kind of air out their issues with the governor's budget, the agencies, et cetera. And with Brad Schimmel, Attorney General, one big issue that he's been trying to deal with and likely be an issue for him next fall is that there are thousands of rape test kits collected from victims that have not been tested. And he made an argument this week that even though we've had these other reports about there's a backlog and it's been there for a long time, he's arguing there's no backlog, which kind of caught some people by surprise, considering there are, again, 6,000 kits that haven't been tested, but was trying to finesse an argument of, look, the ones that are coming in that are current, we're staying current with those. The problem is that these have collected over years and years and years, and he says that in many cases, the kit wasn't tested because the guy confessed, and so they didn't need to, or the guy was caught in another case, and so wasn't a need. But also, there are a number of victims who go to the hospital and have the kit taken, but then decide not to press charges. He's taken a separate effort that's underway to try and reach out to these folks and get them to come forward, but he's made the argument of there's no backlog. And some Democrats were like, that's kind of a problem, you know, to make this argument when there's all these kits that aren't tested. That was a big flashpoint this week.
And Democratic State Representative Katrina Shanklin was one of those who was questioning the Attorney General about that backlog. What did she say?
Well, she was kind of raising this point about, you know, these things have been sitting there for a few years, and Schimmel corrected her and said, no, actually, some have been there for more than a decade. And she's like, well, okay, well, thanks, but that makes it even worse. So that was one of her many issues. Plus, if you look other places, I think like the city of Detroit, for example, they went ahead and tested or tried to start testing these untested kits and didn't, like what Schimmel wants to do, get permission from victims from age-old cases and just went ahead to get these things knocked out. They identified a number of offenders by doing that, and Democrats say, look, this is an example of what can happen if you do this. So I will tell you one thing that Schimmel said about this issue is that of these 6,000, he expected 3,800 to 4,000 roughly would ultimately be tested. Democrats are going to remind him of this next fall. He's up for re-election. This, I'm pretty sure, will be in a campaign ad sometime next October.
Well, and other states have gotten some money to help deal with the backlog because this is a national issue. And, for instance, New York got some money, and they're adding analysts of that. Other states have put in policy into place to deal with them. Is Wisconsin showing that it might do anything similar?
Well, you know, Schimmel's gotten grants in the past to help with this, and he's been saying that a couple hundred kits, you know, the untested ones are going out to private lab every month, but that's going to take time to catch up when you have a backlog or number of untested ones that we have in Wisconsin. And they're mostly housed, he said, at hospitals and local police stations, not at DOJ.
Let's move on and talk about transportation. It remains a big sticking point, a point of contention in the legislature and between Governor Walker and his own party. What is the latest from the hearings there?
The latest is that we're kind of having the same conversation we've been having for about 6 months now, where Governor Walker has been fine-tuning, according to some people, or changing to others, his rhetoric on a gas tax hike. Back in September, a number of us from the press corps went down to Highway 59 off of I-90, as Governor Walker touted some transportation stuff and said at the time that he would veto any gas tax hike or registration fee increase unless there was an offsetting tax cut somewhere else. So, okay, so people thought that was the standard. If you can meet that standard, he might sign something. Well, then the state address came in January, and Governor Walker said, we have plenty of money to pay for roads. Now is the time to raise taxes. Well, fast forward to this week, his transportation secretary, Dave Ross, was testifying before the Joint Finance Committee and, quite frankly, getting beat up a little bit because people aren't happy in the legislature about where we're at with transportation. And Scott Walker took to Twitter and said, flat out, he will veto any gas tax increase. So for Assembly Republicans, who among the GOP legislators and are basically the ones most interested in raising revenues by some way, shape, or form, they feel like Governor Walker's moved the goalposts, that he gave us a standard before, late last summer, early fall, and now he's moved it to here. They're frustrated. Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate Majority Leader, has said, look, and he's been saying this for some time now, if Governor Walker's not going to sign a gas tax increase, there's no point in trying. Let's think outside the box and find something else. And you have Democrats saying, look, you guys, the majority party, you guys run things, and we're still putting off a long-term fix to transportation, what's going on here. So basically, we're kind of stuck in this pattern of one faction wanting more money, Governor Walker saying we got enough, and there's no clear path forward right now to fix that standoff.
Any idea what a something else could be if Governor Walker said no go on a tax, a gas tax?
Well, you have to think of our budget in Wisconsin like if you have a couple different checking accounts, right? So we have one checking account that's we call general purpose, the general fund. That pays for schools, Medicaid, local aid to local governments, those kinds of things. We also have a second checking account, the transportation fund. That's where our gas taxes go, registration fees, federal aid. And one thing you could do, if you wanted to, was take money from that general fund, that checking account, and move it over to the other one. Now, if you do that, however, you are taking money that could otherwise go to K-12 education, the UW system, you know, these other programs that are popular. So it's a risk for Republicans who run the legislature. If they do move that money over, will there be a backlash from voters saying, wait, why are you taking money from my priority over here and putting it toward roads?
So to be continued on that one. As we talk to J.R. Ross right now, editor at WISP Politics for our Wisconsin News Roundup. And self-insurance, another big topic out of the budget hearing this week. How did state lawmakers react to this this plan of the governor's to switch to a self-insurance model for state employees?
There are two things that came through loud and clear this week about what members of the Joint Finance Committee do not like. One is where we're at with transportation, and two is a self-insurance proposal from the governor. For example, John Nygren, who's from a Republican from Marinette, he is in the insurance industry. He does not like this plan because what it does essentially says, okay, the state takes on, instead of having a third party involved, the state takes all the risk with insurance. So if state employees, if they stay healthy for a year or use hospitals less, fewer doctor visits, et cetera, state could save a lot of money. But if we have, you know, catastrophic injuries or things that happen we're expecting, it can cost more. It also would pull thousands of state employees out of the general health insurance pool. So Nygren's very uneasy about this. The problem for lawmakers is this. Governor Walker is built into his budget an assumption that this would save about $60 million between January 1st of 2018 and the end of this budget, which is June 30th of 2019. He then took those savings from doing this, or the projected savings, and took part of the money and put it into K-12 education, tied it directly, actually, to payments per student you have at a school district, took another chunk of the money and put it into a pay raise for state employees in general, and a third chunk into a raise for UW employees. So if you're a Republican lawmaker and you don't like this proposal, you have to figure out a way, if you wipe it out, to find the $60 million that Governor Walker built in to cover the K-12 bump in funding, to cover those pay raises, to cover that stuff for UW. So it makes it difficult. He crafted it in a way that if you don't want to do it, lawmakers, you're the bad guy for cutting this money from schools.
We'll see what happens there. JR, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Anytime. Have a great day.
That was JR Ross, editor at WISP Politics, joining us for our weekly roundup of top Wisconsin news. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the future of health care in the United States with the Affordable Care Act in limbo and congressional Republicans going back to the drawing board.
First, Lawrence Krauss says the story of how the universe came to be, as told by an accumulating body of science, is more riveting than any other story in the world.
In his new book, Krauss tells us why, shares some of the big discoveries in science history, and previews what's next.
He's the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University and co-director of Cosmology Initiative. He's the author of the new book, The Greatest Story Ever Told, so far. Lawrence Krauss joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be with you virtually.
Well, you write that the universe was not created for humans, but that life is kind of here because of messy coincidence. And this is something you write that can be unsettling, a cold, hard fact for human beings. Why do you think it can be unnerving for people to think about the universe in those terms?
Well, thinking of our existence as an accident is for some people disturbing. They'd like to think there's some cosmic purpose why we're here. And it's, in some sense, it seems it consoles them that the universe is so big and strange to think that there's a reason we're here. But in fact, I would argue, first of all, I would argue it's kind of solipsistic to assume the whole universe was created for us. In fact, instead of the fact that we're just a cosmic bystander in an amazing universe, and we're fortunate enough to have evolved intelligence to be able to learn about the universe back to the earliest moments of the Big Bang and learn about its fundamental structures. It, in some sense, in my mind, recognizing that we're a cosmic afterthought doesn't make us our own purpose any less significant. We are here. We have brains. We are on a remarkable planet where that life has evolved for over 4 billion years to get to us, and we should enjoy our brief moment in the sun. We should use our brains and use the results of science to make the future better. And in some sense, the fact that we're in control of our own destiny, if you wish, and that no one else is watching out for us makes it even more important that we act sensibly.
And in your new book, you deliberately use language and ideas from the Bible, things like, in the beginning there was light. You say there had to be. What are you getting at by lining up the scriptural story of creation against the narrative of the universe as told by science?
Well, I guess what I was doing was pointing out how the real story is so much more fascinating. That's why I call it the greatest story ever told so far. Partly it's a takeoff on the Bible story called the greatest story ever told. But the best part of this story is it's the so far part. It gets better. There are new surprises. The universe continues to surprise us. And I guess what I wanted to do was point out that, well, this story that was written 2,000 years ago by Iron Age sort of peasants who didn't know the Earth orbit the sun was their effort to understand how the universe worked. But we have, over the centuries, made incredible progress and the greatest intellectual journeys people have ever taken to understand the way the universe really works, and it is so much more fascinating and surprising, mostly because scientists, you know, are people, and which many people don't realize, and so they have biases and prejudices, and in this story, there are lots of dead ends and red herrings because people follow what they think is the way the world should work, but the great thing about science is it overcomes those biases and sort of drags physicists kicking and screaming in the right direction. And I think that story, a human story, is really, really remarkable. And so by comparison, I couldn't help many people think of the Bible as for many people, the last word on how the universe works. And I wanted, in some sense, to make that comparison. So sure, the sections of the book happen to have Genesis, Exodus, and Revelations, and they're Bible quotes, and they're great Bible quotes, so they're good. So they tend to be relevant to some of the things I'm saying. The Bible is a literary work, and it's got lots of interesting quotes in it. So why not use them?
So the way you see it, can someone be a respectable scientist and a person of faith?
Well, of course, there are respectable scientists who are people of faith. That doesn't, however, make the story any more real. I think, first of all, let me make it clear. Science can't disprove the existence of God or purpose in the universe. All we can say is that there's no evidence of purpose. So if you have a vague sense of deism, that can always be consistent science. And people like Einstein, who didn't believe in a personal God but sort of believed in order in the universe, the God of Spinoza, as he said, were certainly that way. But there are religious scientists. But, you know, I don't think that proves anything, because there are scientists who are Republicans, there are scientists who are Democrats. So I think it's possible for people to hold mutually inconsistent views at the same time. The point is, the science, we have to force our beliefs to conform to the evidence of reality. And as long as the scientists do that, then their personal convictions in other senses are don't really matter. And frankly, most scientists who call themselves people of faith in the sense of one of the world's, you know, major religions, the way many people call themselves, say, Christians, who don't buy all the stuff in the Bible. They just pick and choose what they like, and they, for them, to some extent, Christianity means that they're quote-unquote good people, and that's fine. But what worries me is it by the same token leads to the notion that people who simply don't buy the notion of God are somehow bad people, and that's a notion that I'd like to overcome. It's unfortunate.
We're talking with Lawrence Krauss right now. He's director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University, co-director of Cosmology Initiative, and we're talking about his new book. It's called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. And Lawrence, going back to this idea of a story that's changing because science moves forward, what do you see as the biggest shifts in the scientific narrative in maybe the last 20 years?
Well, what's really neat about the book, I think, by the way, is that there have been huge revolutions in our picture of the universe, not only over the larger scales, in my last book, Universe from Nothing, was about that, but in our understanding of the universe on the smallest scales. We now realize that the universe we see is kind of an illusion, that there's this invisible field everywhere throughout space that affects the properties of the particles that make us up. And if it wasn't there, if it hadn't frozen in that configuration in the early history of the universe, we and everything we see in the universe would not be here. It's kind of like icicles on a window in a winter. And in Wisconsin, you know what that looks like. Mm. And if you see the beautiful pattern of icicles, imagine living on one of those icicles pointing in a certain direction. Well, that civilization would somehow say that direction was very special. It was meant to be there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just an accident. Our existence, in some sense, is predicated on a similar accident. The field froze. We call it the Higgs field in the early universe. And if it hadn't frozen that way, then the particles that make us up wouldn't have mass. And if they didn't, then you wouldn't have stars, planets, galaxies, people, aliens, etc. And that, what's amazing is that's a remarkable claim that there's an invisible field everywhere throughout space. It almost sounds religious, doesn't it, that is responsible for our existence. But what turns it into science is we said if it's there, we have to find it. And it was a 50-year effort after recognizing that solves some real problems in physics and recognizing it, again, you want to shake, when you read this book, you want to shake people and say, you know, you've got the answer, it's right there, but why is it taking you 20 years to realize it? It's all there. But once we finally realized that was the answer, then the question was it the right answer? And that required a 50-year journey to build the most complicated machine ever built, the Large Hadron Collider, to test it. And lo and behold, it turns out to be true. And that frankly, by the way, that surprised me. I really didn't think the Higgs was real. I thought it was an interesting, nice explanation, but nature would find a trickier one. And turns out nature didn't.
Hey, you said you were surprised that it didn't turn up dark matter instead, or proof of dark matter.
Yeah, exactly. It turns out that the Higgs was fairly hard to discover. The Large Hadron Collider wasn't guaranteed to discover it, but the particles, one of the best candidates for the particles that make up the dark matter dominating our galaxy, are particles that in some sense should be visible at the Large Hadron Collider and should have been a lot easier to see. And the fact that they weren't seen first means that, well, it doesn't rule out that idea because there's a large range of parameter space where they could exist, but it's getting harder and harder and a little bit uglier, and maybe that direction is the wrong one. I certainly thought they'd see the candidates for dark matter before, in fact, instead of the Higgs, and it's fine. And what's nice, by the way, people don't realize, if you're a theoretical physicist, the two most enjoyable states to be in some sense, are wrong and confused.
Why?
Because it means there's more to learn. It means our ideas are wrong, and nature is going to surprise us. And that, it's those surprises and mysteries that make life so exciting, and that's what makes the greatest story we told so far. The greatest story is that we didn't invent it. It was revealed to us by nature, and that the so far part, we will continue to be surprised as long as we continue to look out at the universe, as long as we continue to ask questions. And I'm a little worried in the current climate in Washington that there's not an interest in asking questions, whether it's in science, art, music, or literature. The budget cuts are in some sense combating what makes the nation worth defending just to defend it. And it's of some concern to me. The greatest story will continue as long as we keep asking questions and look out. And there's so much more to be discovered. And that's why the story will be better next year. And some of the kids who might read my book hope will make the story better in a generation. And I find that wonderful.
I want to talk briefly before we wrap up here about science education. You say it's being taught kind of like it's a collection of facts, and it's really more than that. It's a method for discovery. Why do you think that's important as you go forward and talk about the value of science in society?
That's a very good question. I think that it is true. We tend to teach scientists a bunch of facts you memorize, and then other people say, well, I have other facts. But science is a process for uncovering facts, for separating the wheat from the chaff, with skeptical inquiry and empirical reliance on empirical evidence, and testing and looking at many sources and testing again. And those tools are not just important for science. They've allowed science to unveil this illusion of reality, which I talked about in the book, but they also allow us to unveil the illusion of reality that occurs in everyday life, in politics. We need the tools of science to have a healthy democracy, to base our public policy on empirical evidence. And we also need it to overcome, in a world where the internet is full of not only facts, but quote-unquote alternative facts, we need to teach students the filter. We don't need to, there's more facts in my cell phone I can get from than I can at a school, but there are more misfacts. We no longer need to treat schools as sort of storehouses of information. They have to teach kids the techniques, the filters to separate nonsense from sense. And that's more important than the facts. Later on, they can get facts, but that allows them to distinguish facts from nonsense. And those are the tools in a world where we're inundated by information and misinformation that we need in order to move forward progressively so we can make policies as a nation that continue to not only make us sustainable, but make the future better than the past.
Lawrence, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Lawrence Krauss is the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University, co-director of Cosmology Initiative, and the author of the book we were just talking about, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far.
Coming up, we'll talk about what's next in healthcare policy and reform. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Ken and his guests look at the latest in politics and share some lessons from American political history. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, when the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, became law in the United States, it became one of President Obama's signature initiatives. The ACA was controversial, to say the least, among GOP lawmakers who worked for the last 7 years to have the law repealed.
With President Trump in office, the Republicans unveiled their replacement for Obamacare, the American Health Care Act. But once the bill came up for a vote, the GOP couldn't gather enough support among its own party and pulled the bill.
The Affordable Care Act is still the law of the land, but what's the future for health care in the United States? Tom Oliver joins us now to talk about that. He's a professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Well, what went wrong as you see it with the American Health Care Act? It's a complicated act to try to replace a complicated law. What happened?
Well, I think we've had a couple weeks of a wild ride in both policy and politics. I think on the policy side, that is changing the healthcare system, there was a bit of a, oh my gosh, and then never mind. So right now, we have not made any changes at the federal level, and it's hard to say exactly what might be changed in the near future. On the politics side, I think it's just getting started, because the effort to try to get a repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act that the Republicans had, as you said, promised for years, has really stirred up the hornet's nest of politics, both within the Republican Party, but it's also emboldened Democrats and independents across the country and in the halls of Congress as well. So it's a really complex picture, and nothing that's going to go away now, because it, of course, affects the rest of President Trump's agenda with the Republican majorities in Congress. Just maybe a quick outline of some of the key things that happened in
Sure.
that the American Health Care Act. Well, first of all, it wasn't put forward by President Trump. It was developed mainly by House Speaker Paul Ryan, right here from Wisconsin, and Trump's Secretary for Health and Human Services, Tom Price, who's a physician by training. It really, effect was not a health care reform bill in a lot of ways. It was a tax cut bill that masqueraded as a repeal or replacement of the Affordable Care Act. What it did was it cut a number of taxes and fees on upper-income Americans, on the health insurance industry, and on medical device manufacturers that were the main way to pay for the expanded coverage of the Affordable Care Act, which provided an expansion of over 20 million Americans getting coverage over the last few years. It also changed the way that subsidies would be given out for premium assistance. Younger and higher income people would do better, while older and lower income people would be worse off, often to the tune of thousands of dollars per person. It also resulted in insurance companies, if it had become law, they would have been able to charge older beneficiaries up to five times the lowest premium, whereas the Affordable Care Act restricts that to three times the lowest rates. And then finally, it really cut back a major expansion of Medicaid that has been responsible for over 11 million Americans getting coverage. And there, of course, are many states, including Wisconsin, which still could come on board and take advantage of federal funding supporting the expansion of Medicaid. So the bottom line was that the Congressional Budget Office, which is the official nonpartisan scorekeeper, came out and said within 3 years, 24 million Americans, by their estimate, would lose insurance coverage, more than had gained coverage under the Affordable Care Act. And while it would save the federal government over $300 billion over 10 years, that amounts to about 1% of our national health spending. So just about every organization representing health care professionals, hospitals and the American Medical Association and the nurses and just about anybody else who actually has to care for people, they strongly oppose this. And it also conflicted directly with President Trump's proclamations, both during the election and since, that everybody will be covered and health care will be much cheaper. So so that's sort of a good start for what happened, and then why things started going wrong is another discussion.
Talking to Tom Oliver from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at healthcare policy in the United States. Tom, let's look at what's next. Right now, Obamacare is still the law of the land. Assuming nothing happens, at least for the next little while, we don't come up with another plan that makes it through Congress, what is next for Obamacare?
Well, we shouldn't assume there will be nothing because, in fact, a few days after the bill was pulled, so that essentially Republicans refused to go on the record about the American Health Care Act, it was revived, at least in the idea of it coming back and being subject to further negotiation between the president and some of the opponents within his own party. Came back, and so there have been negotiations. The so-called Freedom Caucus, the most radically conservative, I'm not sure that they're so conservative, they're not mainstream conservatives. That's a group of over two dozen members of the House of Representatives that refused to support the Paul Ryan's Act legislation, and they did so because they wanted to get rid of the subsidies in general, but they at least wanted to negotiate most of the main features that have been the most popular in the Affordable Care Act. That is, you can't charge or not offer insurance coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. You have to get rid of lifetime limits on coverage. You have to allow young adults up to the age of 26 to continue coverage under their family coverage, and so forth. All of those things were really prominent, but they want to basically deregulate the insurance industry and roll all those things back. And that would get rid of things like maternity benefits, mental health coverage, substance abuse, where, you know, we've got the opioid epidemic going on across the country, lots of other very valuable things, and basically get rid of what are called the essential health benefits that were developed under the Affordable Care Act. So we don't know that there won't be something coming back in some form. But right now, there's members of the Republican Party who don't want to sign on to anything that is clearly going to limit coverage and reduce the number of people with insurance coverage. On the other hand, the radical conservatives, the Freedom Caucus, doesn't want to give in either.
So if you were to start, and this is a hypothetical here, if, say, a bipartisan group in the Senate were to say, okay, we've got Obamacare, whether we like it or not, let's start working on ways to make it work better. What would you suggest as the starting points there?
Well, one of the key constituencies that has to be dealt with here is the insurance industry, because Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, made the choice to expand as much coverage through private insurance rather than through a public option or through allowing young, older adults but not yet ready for Medicare onto Medicare, or even further expansion of Medicaid. The private insurance industry has been asked to come in and offer plans through the state-based exchanges. And those are the ones that have gone through the turbulence over the last couple of years, because individuals, even though they're required to purchase insurance coverage if it's affordable, have not all done that. And so those rates have been in turbulence the last couple of years, and they're getting worse because people have the signal that maybe they shouldn't or don't have to get insurance. So I think you have to come in and help stabilize those private insurance markets that are about 10 million, 11 million folks right now receiving coverage. So that means actually doing a couple of things. It means being serious about, are we going to uphold this individual mandate or not, to get the younger, healthier folks to buy insurance and be in the pool and bring down the rates for everybody else? And will you protect insurers with so-called reinsurance, some highly technical things that basically protect them if their experience and the amount they have to spend on care for the people they're covering is much higher than they expected? Can they be protected and have limits on their losses? So those are two kinds of things that are very private market kinds of approaches to helping, you know, maintain that private insurance.
Tom, I want to jump in and ask that reinsurance idea. I think you've told me in the past that there was something like that, a stabilization fee or risk management support, I should say, that was supposed to be in the Affordable Care Act. It was, but it didn't get funded to the level that people had hoped, and that was part of the problem with the exchanges. Do I have that right?
That's right. There's three different kinds of help that were to help stabilize that were in the Affordable Care Act, but they depend on annual appropriations by the Congress. And of course, when Republicans gained majority control, they've been very skeptical about doing that. So the last few years, insurers are very clear that they would like those back as guarantees in exchange for playing in these pools. Yes.
We're talking to Tom Oliver right now, professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us to talk about what's next in healthcare policy and the future of the Affordable Care Act.
You can join the conversation. What do you think of our current healthcare system? What would you like to see change? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about the American Health Care Act, the House Republican health care bill, why it failed, and what's next for health care reform in the United States. Tom Oliver is with us. He's a professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think should happen in the United States when it comes to health care reform? Were you surprised that the Republican health care replacement didn't work. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. Forrest is with us in Door County. Forrest, hi.
Hey, how are you? I feel like I'm missing something here. Is the reason why the Affordable Care Act under Trump didn't go through was because people wanted, the Freedom Caucus wanted more extreme changes to it? Because I feel like the people are kind of confused about why it didn't pass.
Forrest, thanks. The American Health Care Act. And you were talking about the role of the Freedom Caucus earlier, Tom, but also people point toward Republicans, more moderate Republicans, who thought that the Republican bill went too far in some cases.
Yes. Well, so, yes, the answer, Forrest, is yes. The Freedom Caucus essentially said, wait a minute, you're basically doing Obamacare light. You're offering lots of tax credits, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars over time to Americans. You're redoing that, but it's still government subsidies, number one, and you still have all these regulations on private insurance, and we don't believe in those, and we want those, out of the way. So, yes, they basically refused to compromise on those, and it got down to some things that looked pretty much like going back to the old days not very long ago when a lot of people could not even get insurance because even if it was offered, it would be prohibitively expensive if they were sick or older.
Forrest, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Fiona in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering that now that we've seen with the ACA that we gave the private insurers the opportunity to provide coverage to these marketplaces and we've seen all the issues that have come up with that, is this the time to introduce a public option?
Yeah, well, Bernie Sanders, Senator from Vermont, believes that, and that's exactly what's happened in this last week, sort of coming in on the chaos and all the people, Republicans and Democrats and independents, who showed up at the town hall meetings held by members of Congress in the last few weeks. He's come back with this so-called public option, that is a Medicare for all. That is, something I think people took President Trump at his word. When they hear something like, everybody will be covered and it'll be cheaper, they believe that. And they want to know why that's not going to happen and, in fact, go backwards. So I think it's a very, very difficult situation where you can't get a Medicare for All plan passed right now. But depending what happens with this administration and Republicans facing midterm elections in just a year and a half or so, it may be something that gets on the agenda and picks up steam. And it's interesting because a lot of people who voted for Trump are, in fact, older. They have less work opportunities available to them. They're in more rural areas. And I think something like Medicare for All sounds probably pretty attractive to them, even though they might not be for higher taxes and a bigger role of government per se. Medicare is pretty popular, and that's why the president has stayed away from proposing Medicare cuts.
Fiona, thanks for that call. We'll go next to John on the line in Florence. John, hi.
Yeah, my kind of question, comment, is when the Affordable Health Care Act took effect, my wife's premiums, the family premiums for a family of five, went from a little under $700 to $1,400, and our deductible went from $1,500 per person for the five of us to an $8,250 family premium. So we, in essence, are considered insured, but we can't afford to use our insurance. It never gets to being insured.
And, John, can I ask, was your wife under an employer-based insurance?
A government agency insurance.
Government. Okay, thank you so much, John, for calling in. And, Tom, we've heard this not just from John, but from other callers who, after the Affordable Care Act came into place, for some people, their insurance outlook got worse.
This is true because there were it would be necessary to know what that prior coverage was. If it was under a group-sponsored plan, It's not real clear to me how that kind of increase could happen. But if you came from an individual self-employed or just a individual private family plan where you are signing on all by yourself with an insurance company, that kind of change could happen if you then went into the exchange plans, because you might have had a good deal under individual insurance, but it also might not have had the essential health benefits. It might not have had some of the other protections around pre-existing conditions, lifetime limits, and those kinds of things. So there's no question that a number of people have looked at increasing bills, but by and large, the vast majority of people under the Affordable Care Act ended up better off, not worse off. And so there's a real balance, and I think the secret is, how do we try to deal with the individuals who ended up thousands of dollars worse off potentially if they do get sick? And that's where John's family deserves, I think, some attention from policymakers, just as the insurance companies who ended up losing money that they didn't expect to lose got some protection.
John, thanks for that call. We're talking to Tom Oliver from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, the Republican House effort that failed to come to a vote a week ago today, and what's next for health care in the United States. Back to your calls now with Floyd on the line in Mequon. Floyd, hi.
Hi. I have two questions. First of all, when the Republicans started saying they were going to get rid of Obamacare, the insurance companies started dropping out because they thought it was a losing proposition. So it's essentially become a self-fulfilling prophecy, number one. Number two, isn't it time for a single-payer option where the government does it? Nobody has really looked at what happens when people don't have insurance and they go to the emergency room, where their bills can be 50 or 100 times more than if they went to a doctor. Who's paying for that if they have no insurance?
Floyd, thanks for the call. So that, first of all, Tom, the idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy, Republicans with a bullseye on the Affordable Care Act, so insurance companies may be a little reluctant to stick around in these marketplaces.
Yes, I think they are reluctant, and some of the pullout might be construed to be sort of daring the government to help them make it economically or financially viable to cut, to stay in, and sort of I think somebody pointed out that some huge proportion of beneficiaries under the Affordable Care Act in Nebraska, you know, basically rely on a single company. So if you are that company, you have a pretty strong negotiating position potentially to stay in. I think the single payer issue needs to be floated as a legislative option. And I think, you know, in the future, this is the kind of thing that seniors who were tried to, you know, under both the Affordable Care Act and under the recent proposals, have kind of been left to the side, other than getting some prescription drug assistance under the Affordable Care Act. I think it's time to bring them into the conversation, because they voted, you know, heavily for Trump, and yet they certainly didn't vote on the premise that Medicare was going to be undermined. And so I think the question that's brought up here is that, if this is so good and so popular with seniors, how come not the rest of us? But that's something that's been with us for over 50 years, since Medicare was adopted in 1965, when everybody presumed it would become the basis for national health insurance.
We'll leave it there for now, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
It's a complicated story, and I think the president acknowledged that. So thanks so much for having me, and I hope we made some headway.
That's Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today to talk about the latest in health care reform and what's next after the failure of a House Republican plan.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.